Morning to you all. Here we are. It just seems we were together a very short time ago, and I guess we were. About 12 hours ago, we said goodbye, and here we are again. Good morning, Neil. How are you? Good, good. Wasn't that a great meeting last night at Bob's house? You know, on Thursday I came? Yeah. And we had lunch at the Pizza House, and we were at that meeting, and Bob talked about those huge trees, and how none of them grows alone, and how their roots, they need each other, and they grow in clumps. There are many plants that grow like that, and the bigger they are, the more they need each other. And last night, that's what I was thinking as that meeting was going on, about the strength of everybody that was there and the strength of the expression and the love for Alcoholics Anonymous and the love for God and the feeling of harmony. I won't forget that for a long time. It was really quite extraordinary, and I was so glad you had talked about that on Thursday night, because it really was a demonstration of just that. The strength that we are together. You know, and it reminded me that why do I keep going? And I'm sure those of you who are around a while, you get asked the same thing. Why do you go? I go because I'm a better person when I am part of this thing. Because if there's one thing I've learned, isolation kills me. Isolation kills me because out of it grows the ego. The me, 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 and I'm something, and I'm going to do something, and I'm too busy, and I'm too important, and I'm too God knows what. And none of it is true. And when I come here to the fellowship, and somebody else spoke about he needs the whole package, so do I. You know, even though I'm focused a lot on God consciousness, like many of you are, on God consciousness and prayer and meditation and on service and sponsoring and all that, it's a package. I am part of this thing, and I am proud to be part of this thing. I belong to other organizations too, because I don't want to get stuck and have this kind of focus that AAs are the only people who know anything. AAs are the only people who do good. It's not true. I have been helped many times in my life by people who had not one thing to gain, like that man who came to the hospital room and rapped and said, I saw you at breakfast. Are you alcoholic? And said, I know of a place where you can go. And if you're willing to go, you seem to be in so much trouble, I'll take you. And the next day he was there. He had nothing to gain. He took a day off work to get in his car and drive me 100 miles away and to a place where, and then stayed with me while I had my interview, and I'd never met the man before. And you know, strangely enough, I've never met him again. And I always think one day somebody's going to come up after I'm speaking somewhere and say, that was me. I would love that. But since that has not happened, I can give back. You know, and I think we miss something. There have been a lot of smart people on the planet. I mean, and a lot of God-centered people on the planet as the years have gone by. And I know that from the podium, I know we have to be careful because I don't want the message of AA diluted. I really don't. And I know that we have a singleness of purpose, and I don't want that diluted either. And our singleness of purpose is not to promote a religion. And our singleness of purpose is not about getting involved in political issues. Our singleness of purpose is that we help the fellow alcoholic to recover from alcoholism. But the world is bigger than alcoholics. There are people who are suffering. There are people who are joyful. And sometimes they may need me to show them something or to increase their joy. the deal, I think, is about givingness. When I was, I guess it was about 15 years ago, I was teaching a class on prosperity. The guy that had taught me that I'm not here to set it right, I'm here to see it right, his name was Eric Butterworth, and he had written a book on prosperity. And I was teaching this book from some of the things that he had taught me. And there were two girls in that class. And both of them, at that time, it was at a time when $40,000 a year was a reasonable amount of money. You could live in Toronto. You could read, not great, but you could live. And they both expressed this. They said, our bank accounts are always empty. I said, isn't that interesting? How would that be? Well, they started to recount. And see, it's just a question this had never been proposed to them. They said, well, I have to pay my rent. And I said, what are you paying rent for? Like, why are you giving X numbers of hundreds of dollars to that person? Well, we live in his house or apartment or whatever. Well, I said, is he supposed to give that to you and you return nothing for the service that he has given you? Well, no. I said, what then if you were to think he has provided me with some goodness, and now I am providing him with some goodness. He's given me what I need for my well-being, and now I'm giving him money so that he can continue. And then it becomes, I give to you, and you give to me. They'd never thought of that. And we went through the phone company. I said, when you go to the grocery store, are the farmers supposed to be out there working, saying, oh my goodness, there are two girls in Toronto. We better get going and hoe around here for a while and make sure that those girls get food. What about the transportation? On and on. And what it came to was this. They saw that there was not a thing that they were paying out that they had not first received something, and that they were simply giving something back. You know, I've learned this world is consciousness. Watch what you've got going in here. I don't care how handsome you are, even if you're like Mike. Perfect. You know, you can be perfect. And watch what's going on in here. Because what's going on in here, you will see. I promise you that. And if you think poverty and there isn't enough, you're going to be a person with a long white beard, and you're going to be saying there isn't enough. And we don't have to be that way. The spider knows it all comes from within. And if I will take a look, I finished that story. I said to them, we talked about the things that we have come to see are necessary. When I lived on Skid Row, I had no television, I had no radio, I had nothing. I had just the very, very limited. Poor clothes, one plate, on and on. And I survived. And it was good for my soul. I wouldn't like to do it again. But what I'm saying is, I look at my closets today. It's disgusting. It's disgusting the amount of money that's stuck into the shoes and the clothes and the jewelry and the whatever. And then I look at some of the cupboards and the knickknacks and the fancy stuff of this and that and the other and all the things that now I think I have to have. The best seats in the theater and the best seats at the opera and the best seats at the symphony and all that kind of stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not really attached to it. But what I'm saying is the universe provides, but not if I keep thinking there isn't enough. So I said to these girls, do you put some savings away? Well, never. Our bank account's always empty. And I said, think about some of the things that you think are necessary and that you really don't need. Maybe it's an extra dessert. Maybe it's a trip to the restaurant when you could have made a sandwich at home. Maybe it's coffee at Starbucks when you could have made a coffee at home and taken it that way. I don't know. I love living well, but I also know that there's a higher order that I need to follow, and I do need to watch what's in here. You see? And so I said to them, think. Well, both of them, within 10 minutes, could tell me two or three things that they could do without. And by the time they left, I said, I think it's really important. We're not just dealing with dollars. If we are, that's not what this program is about. This program has taught us that there's a power, that there is a consciousness bigger than we are. It's here. Not out there someplace. It's here. And if we will just let it in and cooperate with it, I don't care what the economy is. Because how in the name of God did I ever get in the situation that I was to buy my first house? You know, I hadn't saved any money because my sponsor made me pay off all my debts. Imagine that. And yet, I think that's why the God shot could take place. And the way was provided for me, and nobody gave me anything. The universe provided the way that I could buy that first house. And so they decided that they would put something aside. Why? Any idea? That's it. Because what you're saying is, thank you, universe. How wonderfully you provide for me. How wonderfully you have provided for me. I have enough that my needs are taken care of, and I have more than I need. Now we're talking. See, if we stay stuck with stuff, we're going to stay stuck with stuff. And then we're up to trying to manipulate and make the world work. Somebody else taught me something else. Said, never say I need this. See, these are people who come of the ilk of Chuck Chamberlain, who come from the ilk of Joel Goldsmith, who come from the ilk of people who were deeply spiritual and who believe that God is within, that God is my life. You know, sometimes I think we have to ask ourselves, what would I go to the wall for? What would I not back down? What do I believe so strongly that I'd go to the wall for it, whatever that means? And one of them is that May the 20th, 1973, a power that I can't describe touched me, did something in my being. Something flowed in my being, and that I was drastically changed. Not perfected, changed, because the compulsion and the obsession was gone, so that I was freed of that, so I could start to make decisions. See, I think when those things happen to us, it doesn't mean that I don't have to do any work. I have to cooperate with it. But getting back to that, that's one thing I would go to the wall for. And another thing that I would go to the wall for, I absolutely believe that I'm a God being and that God shows up and appears to be me. And it's my job, whatever, however else you cut it, my job today is to make sure that I am as much as possible doing that which is mine to give. Today, it's to stand up here. Tomorrow, it may be to sit in the chairs where you are, or sit on an airplane and see some other folks, or be in an airport, or be wherever. But to practice love and to practice God consciousness. See, that I'd go to the wall for. There isn't much else I'd go to the wall for, but that I would go to the wall for. Do I live that out perfectly? No. But that's what I'm about. That's why I do the things I do. That's why I meditate. That's why I read spiritual books. That's why I try to practice the presence of God. That's why I try to do the things I said I would do. And when I get stuck and I need to make amends, I do that kind of stuff. That's a way of life. I was going to say, some of the teachers that I've had of the ilk, I said, of Chuck Chamberlain, Wesley Parrish, Mac Cheater, if you can ever get tapes of these guys, get them and listen to them. Cease Corrigal, their souls shone out from them. And when they spoke, they had a message. And I was privileged to know every one of them. And they weren't preachers. They talked the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I found out that all of them were deeply spiritual. You know, Cease Corrigal used to get up and he'd give this talk and he'd tell stories and jokes as only Cease could. He's 59 years sober now. He's had a stroke. And, you know, he has the same modus operandi with people he treats. He loved women when he was well, and he loves women when he's sick, and he treats them with the same dignity, whether they're 18 or whether they're 88. I love that kind of truthfulness, that kind of simplicity, that kind of integrity. And, you know, he'd get up and he'd tell these jokes about foot, you know. And I knew that the morning before he left the house, he'd sit and meditate and read his spiritual books for an hour and a half. And then he'd get up and he'd take his show on the road. Cease was a fur salesman. And they used to have in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, a small city, they used to have the biggest conference in the West. Gather them from, everybody came, from way from Texas and the South, and everybody went home with a fur coat. It was always the joke, you know, that all these fur coats were going back to with everybody. But that I learned something from them. That was the guts of them. That's where they got that spirit. Mac Cheater could get up here, and you knew that you were listening. Isn't that true, Bob? You knew him. Oh my goodness, what radiated from him. That's what I would go to the wall for. And everything else has flowed from that, you know. I've had a fabulous life, sometimes fabulously painful. I know I started to say something. It was one of these folks who said to me, never say to the universe, I need. Because the universe is a conscious being. It listens to you. And if you say, I need, the universe will say, well, there's somebody who needs. God doesn't have a warehouse in the sky. It doesn't work like that. If I, you know, I chased some for a while. I chased some of these gurus who came to town and were teaching, do affirmations, do visualizing, do this, do that, and, you know, determine the end, see where you want to be in 5 years. And I tried it all, and it all went up in smoke. And then through the program and surrendering, amazing things happened. Kid that lived on Park Bench, I buy all these houses. I have my own big house built. You know, I did things. Came in here, you know, and I couldn't put two words together. And in the year 2000, was privileged to be one of the speakers at the International in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, yes. And you know, not a thing of this is about me personally. You see, what I hope I can convey is that these steps aren't just stuff we do so we can say we did them and stuff we can talk. They're supposed to change me inside. And I've done a lot of suffering. I've done a lot of talking. I've done a lot of following people and thinking, now, I'm going to do it that way. I'm going to do it that way. And where it's all come to is, here I am, Father. Show me the way. And everything gets done. You see, often, when I think I need, I want something, I think I need it. And really, I don't need what I think I want. The thing that is given to me is simply another layer of trouble. When I was done with my husband, and he was done with me, very done, and we separated and got a divorce, and I thought I needed a man. Always need a man. And there was this guy at the group. He was fabulous. He was so slick. He was so handsome. And honest to God, he just talked. It was like honey flowing out of his mouth. He knew those steps, I'm telling you. He'd sit there and I'd just sit there drooling. Well, I don't have to tell you, it wasn't long before we had a relationship. I wasn't concerned that he had a wife. Shame on me. Anyway, we had this relationship going for about 3 weeks. And one day he called me. And he said, I've been drinking. I said, you what? You've been drinking? And immediately I thought, well, he's got me now. I'll show him how not to drink. What I didn't know. Oh, yeah. Hey, those hormones can do great stuff, I'll tell you. Oh, yeah, 51 years. Good. Keep going, Mary Lou. So, I guess I was 2 years sober at the time. And so, for the next 2 years, my whole life revolved around him, seeing where he was and what I should tell him and how I was going to control his life. And, you know, one day he was going to get it. Till one day, you know, and then I had the big sponsor by this time with the size 16 shoes, and he was not happy with me. And one day I come home. The only smart thing I did, I never lived with him. The only smart thing. And I came home, and he was in my house, and he was lying on the bed. Now, I've got the advantage. I'm not drinking. I'm strong. I'm standing up on 2 feet. He's lying on the bed shaking. And he says, Millie, get me some beer. I said, beer? You pray. He said, I don't want to pray. At which point, I grabbed his ears. And I pounded his head on the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. Oh, yeah. Aren't you fellas glad you missed me? Now, I've got this God complex. I'm going to fix him. I got to fix my sister Dora. I'm no different. I've got to fix Brian. And so finally, I had this idea. If I break up with him, you know, this was a dreadful relationship. I wouldn't put up with not a thing of what went on in that relationship, the way he spoke to me and all that. And that, I don't mean this was my stuff. But I believed that if I broke up with him, he was going to drive his car into Lake Ontario. I mean, how could you live without me? Keep that in mind, Mike. And so, worst case, you know, things went on, and my sponsor was not telling me I had to. He was a good sponsor. He let me make my own mistakes. But one day we broke up. The amazing thing is this. He did not drive his car into the lake. 6 months later, he got sober. And he had 16 years without me of really good sobriety. He was a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he got cancer and died. And there's an example of something I thought I needed, that I wanted, and it turned out really in God's purpose. I learned a lot through that relationship. Then I got another man. He was even better. He was 5 years sober. He was about your height, Neil. And his name was... No. I don't want to say in case anybody should ever hear this tape. And got to be a little careful here, judicious. And, you know, for 2 years it was wonderful. You know, and when you say I don't know how to do relationship, I sure as heck didn't. You know, and we had a great 2 years. We were sexually attracted to each other. You know, we had a wonderful time. And I was so happy, and people would say, my goodness, you're so happy all the time. Yeah, right. And I thought I was transformed. But I didn't know I was getting laid frequently. I just didn't make the distinction. And then one morning I woke up and I said, I wonder who that is. You know, that isn't what life is. You know, it's nice. It brings us together. Freud said that when the hormones flow, we get 90 days of socially acceptable insanity. Because we make a juice that causes all this to flow. And then the work of relationship started. And I didn't know how to do relationship. And I was behind the walls. And guess what? So was he. We didn't know how to talk to each other. And we stayed together for another 13 years. You know, in our own way, trying to make this work. You know, we could have just as well been honest and after 2 years said goodbye, because not much went on except painful stuff. And what I learned was that if you can't communicate, and I couldn't communicate, I'm not the person today that I was then. And he couldn't communicate. So what happens is you don't learn who that person is. That person is a concoction that you have in your head. You don't see the real person, and you don't love the real person, and you don't respect that real person and have a relationship going on. And it was after 15 years of that we said goodbye. And, you know, everything went. The friendship we had at first went. The sexual stuff went. There was really nothing left. We looked good. I looked good, you know, and we had everything. And people would say, oh, you look so good together. And I used to think, you don't know anything. There's nothing going on between us. I never want to live that way again. I've often said, I will never, ever pretend that I am in a relationship with somebody that I have to look past. I've sat at too many dinner tables looking past somebody and had nothing to say because they just didn't know the person. So, after that relationship broke up, you know, that was the end of that food, you know, and I took some time really to grow. And it was in this period that I did the step eight work that I described to you, and I really changed. And I always tell the men when I give retreats, I give a lot of men's retreats these days, and I always tell them that I'm taking resumes. Keep it in mind. And I get some, too. But I'm still alone. And, you know, I don't talk about this much, but really, this is all, I guess, in a way, part of step 10. I didn't attempt to start this way, but living alone requires some skills, too. You know, often we talk about what, you know, the difficulty of living with somebody. And I believe that. But living alone also means you've got to take an assessment and figure out how you can live comfortably. Because there are all kinds of things. If I wouldn't be careful, I could isolate. Because there's nobody, you know, so I go to a party and feel, maybe say, I don't think I want to get dressed and go, and there's nobody to say, come on, we're going. You've got to find the resources within you to take the commitments that you said you would do. The decisions that have to be made. You find out how to make friends. You know, the interesting thing is, I have all kinds of men friends. They have wives. They know I'm not after their body. They're just friends. I have all kinds of women friends, too. Couples that are friends. And, you know, it's really a great experience to be able to operate from the truth, to operate from an open heart, and to welcome people in and to know how to do that. I love to give dinner parties, and people love to come to my dinner parties. And, you know, all kinds of what. I have a really wonderful life. Sometimes it feels lonely. And sometimes I just have to sit and say, God, I know that you're here. It would feel nice to have somebody with skin on, but there's nobody here with skin on, so you'll do. You know, it's nice to do these steps. Well, it's wonderful to do these steps. And then we come to the end of 9. And then 10, we call 10, 11, and 12. I don't know. We used to call them the maintenance. I think that's not a good word. I don't want to maintain what I had at the end of step 9. I want to keep on growing, and I need to keep on growing. And I think really that's what step 10 is encouraging me to do. I want to talk a little bit about this, and then I'll talk a little bit about what's in the big book and what's in the 12 and 12 that has attracted me. And maybe if I'm here 5 years from now, I'll talk about different stuff. Did any of you read this? I read it quite frequently. It's Bill's article on emotional sobriety, which he starts out by saying, I think many oldsters who have had our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find we often lack emotional sobriety. Isn't that interesting? So you can be 25, 30 years sober and still not have it all together. Perhaps they will be spearheaded. No, this they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA. And I think that's true. The development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say, humility, in our relations with ourselves and with our fellows and with God. And then he talks about adolescent urges. I love this. He says those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance, urges, quite appropriate when you're 17, proved to be an impossible way of life at 47 or 57. And I would say not only an impossible way of life, very unattractive. Very unattractive. So he goes on to say, I've taken immense wallops in these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. See, that's why I said yesterday, Dr. Bob's much too good for my way of doing stuff. I relate to this stuff. He says, my God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and that we realize finally all along we've had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. You know, I think about those 13 years that I was with this, in a relationship with this man. It was an emotional merry-go-round. The highs of feeling, maybe this, now we've got it, and we'll be okay together, and the back down into the unability. You know, and it comes to us in different ways. He says, how do you translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result? I think that's such a powerful statement. How do you take the right mental convictions that you may have taken on this weekend into a right emotional result? How do you take it? How are you going to take it with you and put it into practice when you go home? And take it into good, easy, happy living. Then he goes on to say, I'm not going to read the whole thing, don't worry. But he says, even then, as we hew away, he's acknowledging here that he had made some progress. Peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many of us oldsters have come to. And you know, I talk about this stuff in one way or the other whenever I do a retreat, and certainly, and even when I speak at a conference. And it's always interesting to me how many people come up who say, that's where I'm at. I'm 15 years sober. I'm 20 years sober. 25 years sober. And I'm having difficulty with this kind of stuff. He says, how shall our unconscious be brought into line with what we actually believe? See, there we go. Unconscious and what I actually believe. I go to the wall for the idea that I believe God is everything, but I've got crap in my unconscious, and if you throw the rock into that pond of mud, the mud is still going to come up, and I have to deal with it. And that's what he's talking about. He's so real. He's so real. He says, how to convince our dumb, raging Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. And then he talks about he felt he was starting to get some results, and then he feared that this depression would again take him to the cleaners. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? And I'll bet you there are people sitting in this room today who have said that. Why can't the 12 steps work to release me from lust? Why can't they work to release me from depression? Why can't they bring me money? Why? And then he says, he stared at the St. Francis prayer. Suddenly I realized what the matter was. Here it comes. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people, circumstances, which would supply me with prestige, security, and the like. See? Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams, I fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. There wasn't a chance that I could practice the prayer of St. Francis and be a channel of love. I'll tell you, when my unconscious, when the rock goes in that pond and the mud comes up, there's not a chance that you're going to get any love from me for a while. Even you. he goes on to say that he got waylaid almost, because he said, I had undergone some spiritual development. And isn't that the truth? We do the steps. We do the steps more than once. That's not a guarantee that self is going to be wiped away. We can be of service. All very good. We go to our meetings. We go to our home group. We do the best we can. And we think, I'm going to manage well, and therefore I'm going to feel okay. And here he says, because he had gone through some growth, the vicious nature of what was happening inside eluded him. And then he realized the almost absolute quality of these frightful dependencies were starkly revealed. So here's a man, co-founder of AA, and after all these years, he's still dependent on people and circumstances and events. I found that I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies. You know, that's why I think we have such a rich tradition, and it's such a powerful tradition, because we've got the tradition of what's written. We have the oral tradition of what we pass on to one another. We have the tradition of getting together on a regular basis. We have the tradition of service, getting out of ourselves and giving something to the world instead of sitting there whining and saying the world should give something to me. We have such a great tradition. And he said, I found I had to, and sponsorship, that's also what I wanted to say. And the people, I think of all the wonderful people. God, I've met great people in AA. People that, you know, I think about, and not just those people that I mentioned, Wesley Parrish and Chuck Chamberlain, and yeah, I love those folks. And I have a real debt of gratitude. But I think sometimes I go to a meeting and you don't know what's sitting in those chairs, just like you don't know what's sitting in these chairs unless you know people. One night we had a man get up, and it just blows me away when I think about it. He got up and he shared his experience, strength, and hope. And his experience, strength, and hope involved this: that 10 years before, his 15-year-old son had contracted, got a disease, and died. And 2 years after that, his 13-year-old son got that same disease and died. It was something genetic. And after the second son died, the third son got it, and he had lost all three children. And you know how you get a feel about people. There was not a spark of self-pity in that man. And what he said was, he was grateful that he had had these children, and now he had dedicated himself to the children in AA. And that he was happy that he was a member, that he knew what he, you know, where he belonged, and that he could help other people. I remember that man. I remember a man who, we had our ORC, the Ontario Regional Conference, come sometime. It's fabulous. And he was out and about serving. He was on the committee. And I knew that he had a big growth on his tongue and he had a big growth on his jaw. And you would never have known it. My heart just went out to him, because I knew Monday morning he was going to be in the hospital. And they didn't know what was going to happen, if they'd have to take out part of the tongue or what was going to happen. As it turned out, he is, you know, more or less restored to health. But I remember watching him. And again, he was of service. I just love what I see here. You know, I've seen people, they're losing their homes. And they're carrying on. you can look at your own heroes and see what's going on in their lives. This is powerful stuff. Not because it's called AA. Yeah, we can say that. But because of the grace of God that uses this vehicle to do its work. You know, as we sit here today, well, let me finish this. He said, I couldn't possibly avail myself of God's love as long as I was victimized by these dependencies. He says these words may not mean much to you, but they were the ones that helped trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind. This seems to be the primary healing circuit. It is almost absolutely clear to me that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken. See? Up to yesterday, I think, I was stuck in the fear of something until I could say, whatever happens, however it turns out, I'm okay with it, God. And then the paralyzing fear is gone. And what it takes to get to that place, often it's a lot of prayer, many times of surrender, not just once, till you really get to it where you're so fed up with feeling lousy, you're so fed up with not being able to do it, and there's the truth, and this is the way I feel, and one day they come together. So he says, if we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependency and its consequent demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. You know what hobbling means. You tie the feet together and people can't walk freely. And when I think life has to go some way, I'm hobbled. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these. And then he ends by saying, nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been given a quiet place in bright sunshine. I relate to that. Do you? There's still copies if anybody needs a copy. I just want to say a few words and then we'll take first break. About step 10. You know, Bob talked last night about, and has mentioned this a couple of times, how, he hears things and it's as if he has known them all the time and yet he's never heard them before or feels whatever. That's the way step 10 was to me about 3 or 4 years ago. I felt I'd never really paid attention to it. You know, I always, step 10, you continue to take inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admitted it, goodbye. And that was my step 10, and I started to read this thing. It says, we take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes. He says, we vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. How would you dress if you entered the world of the White House? It's just a house. It's just where human people live. How would you dress if you went to Buckingham Palace? See, the question is, am I to be dressed? Not in the physical clothes, but in my thoughts and my words and my actions. If I have entered the world of the Spirit, what is appropriate? Do I speak the way I would speak in the house of the Spirit? Do I act? Do I think the way I should? And then he says, and this blew me away, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. you know, at 51 years. You wouldn't be here if you didn't believe that. Isn't that true? You know, the truth of the matter is, this hit me. I've got to keep growing. Today is wonderful, but I've got to keep doing and maybe learning and continuing to do the things. And as St. Paul says, it's not yet known what we will become. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. You know, I saw that in Cease. Get a copy of one of Cease's talks if you can. Have you got any, Doug? The old timers? They're fabulous. Cease had had a stroke. At the time, I think he was 51 years sober. Cease was always a ladies' man. And, I went to the home where he was staying. He's 51 years sober. He's had a stroke, and his lip is paralyzed. He can still walk with a walker and so on. But what really attracted to me was when I walked into the room, he was sitting at lunch with a bunch of little old ladies. And he was as charming to them as if they were all 18 years old. It said he didn't have to say any more. See? Continue. We need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, if you're sitting there and you think you got it all together and you think you know it all, I know there's nobody here like that. No, I'm serious about that. I look at the person I know talks a lot, and that's Bob, and I know, Bob, you always are continuing to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, and I love to see that. And, of course, my mic, absolutely. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. And then he says, continue to watch. And he goes through those things that we do, which are the short form of the steps. Watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When they crop up, ask God to remove them at once. We ask God at once. Got to put that in the proper place. We discuss them with someone, immediately make amends. So in other words, we're trying not to add garbage to what has already gone on. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance is our code. Now, the next paragraph really speaks to me. I do not believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is just a bunch of nice people helping each other. I think we blow it if we think that. You know, I think of some of the wise ones that I follow. There have been lots of wonderful people who've written lots of stuff. You know, some of the, I hate to call them saints, but people who have followed a spiritual path. And they say, look, we're not here to be good human beings. We're here to be enlightened human beings. Good human beings, I used to be a good human being. I wasn't enlightened. A good human being can often have very poor motives. I'm going to do it for you because you'll like me. I'll do it for you because then I'll get a reputation of being a kind person. I'll do it for you because if I ask this, then you will give me what I want. Better than murdering and raping, but it's not the ideal. You see? If you can get to God consciousness, that's what I believe it's about, so that when I deal with you, I know I'm not just dealing with a body. I'm not just dealing with a person. I am dealing with God showing up. And then instead of just being good human beings, then we become enlightened. And it does work, and I'll tell you, your life will take off in ways, if you do that, that you couldn't even imagine. We have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. He says sanity will have returned. You notice in this particular paragraph, there are three passive voices. And passive voices mean you are not the doer, you are the recipient. You see? It says here, our new attitude toward liquor has been given us. It doesn't say, I have made it possible to have a new attitude. It has been given us. And then he says, we feel that we have been placed in a position of neutrality. I didn't place myself in a position of neutrality. I have been placed in a position of neutrality. And then the last passive voice there, it says, the problem has been removed. Well, then you have to ask yourself, if this is passive voice, who did it? Was it my sponsor? Was it my group? No. The book says human power can't do it. The book says I can't do it myself. And what are we led to? We're led to that great reality. And then he says a statement. I have to keep it in mind. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. You know, I think some of you who are sober a while, even those younger who've done the steps, there's an urgency in doing one and two and three and four and five and six and seven. And then when you get those amends done, now what? If you're not careful, there's not the same urgency that there was. And he says, what we really have is a daily reprieve. It doesn't say a lifetime. It doesn't say a weekly. It doesn't say a monthly reprieve. It says a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I don't think that says contingent on the maintenance of perfection. It, I believe, is conditioned on the maintenance of my awareness of the presence of God, even if I'm having a little detour today. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. I want to give you St. Paul's definition of, I'll write it down after a while. I don't believe that God's will is about situation. And I don't believe it's about condition, and I don't believe it's about people. And oftentimes people get so caught up, should I do this? Should I take this job? Should I do that? I don't think there's a wrong decision. You make the best decision you know how, and if it turns out that it wasn't a good decision or that it is not a helpful decision, you make another one. And people say, well, you know, I just don't want to have to move and that kind of stuff. Stop taking the things, take those ideas off. I don't want to do this. Let life come and get you. If you will let life come and get you, you won't be disappointed. St. Paul put it this way. He said, this is God's will. And I believe this, because if you can do this, you are on a great path. These are the three things he said. Pray without ceasing. That doesn't mean be babbling prayers. We pray with our life. We pray with how we do our lives. We pray in that way. He said, rejoice always. Rejoice. Why? Because we're on a good path. Hey, if you're alcoholic the way I am, and you don't have a compulsion today, and you're not living on the street, rejoice. Rejoice always, because you are aware of the presence of God. And then the last one he said, in all things, give thanks. Some of these, you know, gratitude lists do not impress me, because all they are, I like this, I like that, I like that. That's good. Give me some more of that. I don't think that's a gratitude list. That's just a me, I like what you gave me. What about if stuff happens that I don't like? That should be really on the gratitude list, because that's the stuff that's going to force you, that's going to help you see where your self-centeredness is at stake. And if you want, then you can do something about that. So, he says we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Do you have a vision of God, what God would want from you? Good idea to think about that. Often we think about what the boss wants, or what the girlfriend wants, or what the boyfriend, or the husband, or the children, or something else. What does God want from me today? And then he says, how can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. Then the great statement, we can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. What I find, I was just doing a step study in Toronto two or three weeks ago, and we came to this statement. And what I found was some of the people in the group did not distinguish between willpower and self-will. They're not the same thing. One of the gifts of God to us is willpower. Because if you didn't have that gift, how are you going to run your life? Then indeed, you are going to be a victim. Because if you don't have the willpower to say no, or the willpower to say, yes, I will do this, I will accept this, that's what willpower is all about. Self-will says, it's got to go my way. See, the one is a gift. The other is what keeps us stuck. And I love it that Bill says, like, how did you get here this morning? Some of you may have had to exercise real willpower. You wanted to sleep in, but you got out of bed and you got here. Right, Michelle? It is the proper use of the will. See? And I think if you make that distinction, and then there's a paragraph that leads us into step three. So why don't we take a 15-minute break, and I'll see you at 10:30.